Okay, so you're recording?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I'm recording, yeah.
Cool.
This is probably just, we're probably too boring. We're probably going to start again.
Oh no, that's all good. It's all good. That's why we can edit. It's the magic of editing.
Yeah.
So how you been?
Oh, I'm good. And how are you? Welcome to fatherhood.
It's awesome. Everyone should do it.
There'd be people who'd be concerned and say you shouldn't say that.
What are balls for?
There's too many people in the world already.
No, there's not enough.
Yeah.
That is such an interesting subject. I get really angry, actually, over that one.
Yeah.
You know, working in a PC environment and you've got the whole sort of sustainable this and sustainable that. And I thought, you people don't know what you're actually saying. It's like no, we live in...
I don't think anybody knows what they're saying these days. They just regurgitate.
Mm. Yeah, it's like the pedal has gone all the way to the metal on crazy. It's getting really concerning, just the whole... Everything's a slogan. You know, people just rattle off these sort of water cooler slogans.
Yeah, that's it, you know, and... If you ask them to think about it, I don't think they've ever thought about it, you know. And they seem to be able to work at justifying what they're saying, but that seems to be like another slogan, you know. It's another, you know, have you ever actually really stopped to think about what you're saying? No, because, well, they've heard it from someone else, or they've heard it through the TV or learned it in school or whatever, and it's just out it pops.
It's really frightening, actually, how people's default position is, you know, just regurgitating what they heard on the telly.
Yeah.
Because I was pondering it the other week. You know, whenever you're going to challenge someone on any subject, there's this real tendency to sound crazy right off the bat. Yes. And especially with the big stuff, the media-driven stuff.
So. Yeah, you're right, because it's so true. The media stuff is so true. It's been repeated so many times. You can't fault it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been learning with having a new bubby in the house. You've got everybody. You've got midwives, you've got Plunkett, you've got Ministry of Health, you've got the maternity guys at the hospital, you've got everybody's got these opinions, and sometimes they're in conflict. And we certainly learned, I think, probably the hard way about where to put your faith and your trust, especially with regards to so-called quote-unquote experts on child rearing, because you've literally got to throw the book out and start from scratch, I think. Although we were lucky, we actually landed someone pretty damn good on the aftercare support. Yeah. I mean, we've hit it. Kind of, you know how you got your little I don't know. You're sort of wandering along, you got lost, and then bang, out of the dark comes someone with a lantern, and they say, "Oh, this way."
That's what you want. That wisdom of old, you know, the learned experiential wisdom. Not the stuff that you go to school somewhere and you know, learn to regurgitate or, you know,
yeah,
to spew back out again. But someone who's actually been there and, you knows the ins and outs and, you know, has done it, has felt it, has made mistakes and learned.
Well, Marie's got a wise woman in the background feeding wisdom, and it's worked a treat, actually.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, no, proper, guaranteed, 100% wise woman.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't know, this is, after we had a week in maternity,
mm-hmm.
which was incredible, because we're only allowed 3 days normally.
Yeah.
And then they kick you out.
Yeah.
But it was interesting being inside the system and seeing what the system had in store for you. Oh, God. Never want to go near it again. But it got me thinking, because we had that really little brief chat, Skype the other day, and you were talking about family, and I got to thinking about family connections, and then, of course, you go back to the origins of, you know, creating families from scratch, and then what happens when other people get involved. And I started getting interested in Plunkett. Da da da.
Maybe not everyone who's listening would know what Plunkett is. Da da
yeah.
da.
Da da da. No, well, if you're Australian or British, you might. But if not, then yeah, basically it's a child support or mother support agency thing that was set up ages ago. And I'll tell you what, it's shrouded in. Here we go. You know, when we spoke about the dangers in this country, at least, of talking about, say, like Anzac Day,
mm-hmm.
and how if you criticise it in the least, people look at us like we're witches.
Oh, that's like, oh, scary.
You can't criticise Anzac Day. Well, in the same way, you run a risk if you criticise Plunkett, which is basically saying, you know, you're going to take this institution that's meant to deal with helping mums raise healthy little kitties, and you're going to start kicking over the rocks to see what's underneath. And what scampers out was something quite interesting. I know you haven't got, like you don't do telly time, but there's a show on TV recently with this lady called Jackie Brown, and she's had a baby, so she recorded the whole experience in a tasteful way, and she looked back at Plunkett, and that got me interested. And I started looking back at Plunkett. And I don't know, it's like things start falling into place. Do you remember Plunkett at all when you were little? Or did you have it when you were growing up?
Well, because we were, what do you call those people? Immigrants, that's right. So,
oh.
And we were, when we came here, we were already born. But my little brother, who's 8 years younger than me, the Plunkett was around then,
yep.
But because of my mother's personality, all I remember about Plunkett is that when the nurse came to the door, we all had to hide and pretend there was no one home. So that's as close as I got to a Plunkett nurse.
That is marvellous. But in all the wrong ways.
Perhaps that was a wise move. Perhaps, you know, you're right. I've never thought to question it.
Neither.
It's that all that backing, all those hundreds of or 100 years behind it of, you know, doing good and.
Mm. And on the surface of it, here we go. This is the one step too far. Fitzy's gone off the edge. On the surface of it, the idea of a nice lady coming around and visiting young mums and seeing, you know, are you getting on and giving helpful advice and helping out with weighing the kid and seeing making progress, it all makes sense on paper. And depending on the individual, it makes sense. And I started thinking about it big time because this lends itself to something incredible. And it goes back to stuff that we talked about earlier this year. And when the stupid document opened with any less, I did a quick bit of surfing, and I've got to admit, this is not thorough. And I'm also biased. So
I noticed, yes.
I have looked for things that support my argument.
Yeah.
So there you go. I'm being upfront about that one. Well, you know, if I was a bit more, you know, media savvy, I'd give a rounded, like the media ever gives a rounded story. Anyway, this is what I was interested in anyway was it was set up by a guy called Truby King. Warning.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so women, childbirth, child rearing. Warning. Anyway.
A man called King. Okay, well that's interesting to start with.
Oh yeah, well it gets better. You can look him up on the net. But anyway, it says I made some quick notes, so these aren't very thorough. But basically, he was in New Zealand. I think he was British, but he was in New Zealand. He went back to the UK, studied mental illness,
mm-hmm.
Did some reforms in Britain, which seemed to be quite effective, at least.
Back up. So he studied mental illness. Sorry, this is the baby guy.
Yeah. He was interested in a lot of things. He was a polymath.
Okay.
So he was reasonably, it seems like he was reasonably interested in a lot of things.
Okay.
But he studied, in the UK, he specifically studied mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped improve a circumstance and believed that improving people's lot with a mental illness include things like good health, good diet, exercise, hobbies, you know, positive experiences and genuinely fulfilling work.
Mm-hmm.
So he set up, he had this farm, which was a farm that had been set up as a mental sort of retreat or a working farm with mental patients. And what he did, he showed up there, he kind of improved it. And he learned a lot about people. It stuck with him, like this notion of mental illness anyway, it stuck with him. And he got involved with health in a bigger way. And in 1907, he addressed a meeting in Dunedin promoting the health of women and children. And they formed a society called the Society for the Promotion of the Health of Women and Children, which is nice, which was later known as the Plunkett Society after a lady, Victoria Plunkett, who was the wife of the governor of New Zealand at the time and a great supporter. So effectively, we've got a chap who's quite, he's an interesting character. I wouldn't say he's sinister at all. He doesn't seem to be sinister, but an interesting character, and away he goes. He forms this thing that it turns into what we call the Plunkett today. His reputation of expertise in infant welfare sort of took off, and he made a few exaggerated claims about how Plunkett and general infant welfare infant welfare techniques could improve infant mortality and you know, not lose so many kiddies. And he was also quite a good orator. So he ended up really getting Plunkett rolling in this country. And people went, this is great. And, you know, kids will survive. And it's a great thing. So I'm not going to knock him for that. I think he probably seemed to have his heart in the right place, at least on that front. What's interesting is what happens when he passes away eventually. And the notes I copied off the net here say that Treby King's legacy, widespread in New Zealand and Australia and Britain, was the doctrine of feeding by the clock.
Oh.
Right. Now, this is huge because from this stems a whole lot of new stuff. The Treby King system became formalized into a rigid set of rules. Now, not that Treby King himself was necessarily promoting it that way. So not to slander that man, what happened was we ended up with a period of insistence in New Zealand where Plunkett nurses would effectively harangue mums to feed their kids on the clock, not a second before. And we've had the midwives say this to us.
Right.
That they were taught that by Plunkett, they had to do things exactly by the book. Like it was a methodical thing. Mm-hmm. And if you fed your kid, you know, a minute before or a minute after, you weren't sticking to the regimen, and you know, terrible things will happen. So we've got babies all around the planet. Well, okay, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, who, you know, the Plunkett Society's ticking over. You've got Plunkett nurses coming around in uniform, mind you,
mm-hmm.
and telling young mums, you got to do this, this, and the other thing to get a healthy baby, regardless of the infant's actual state. Now we know from experience that our bub will eat when he's bloody well hungry, and that can vary.
Exactly, and that's what I did with my son. It's pretty basic, you know.
Yeah.
I've had to put a lot of you would have had to do a lot of mind fucking to override that natural impulse in the mother. You hear the cry,
yeah,
and you just, well, partly it's just the first thing you generally do is offer the food, you know, are they hungry? And because it's just so unpleasant to hear your child cry, you know, you just
I've learnt yeah. The hard, I mean, I had no idea, now I know your child cries, and I think if you're a real human being, you know, fuck all this Jehovian male stuff, if you're a real human being, you feel pain yourself,
yeah.
You know, it triggers a pain response in you. You're like, I must deal with this right the second. And it's not like, oh, I'll get around to it. It's like, no, fuck it now. It has to happen now. It's amazing and good. I think that there's that kind of imperative.
So you can look at it in a sense, this is another way of coming in, because I just wonder more and more about families and how did they get so dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And you can see this is another, you know, probably if you step back and had a look, you would find it's been attacked from so many different, you know, places. It's just you know. And that's a very interesting point. I hadn't, yeah, again, they're another little sacred cow that you don't...
You don't question.
No. Yeah.
And it gets better. Now, there was a paper I had a quick scan over. Like I said, I've been a bit biased. I've been looking for things that support my argument. So it is, you know, it can be pulled up short on this. If I go back and look at it again, I might be a bit more balanced. But in the paper written by De Morse in a document called The History of Childhood, considers that from the mid-20th century, the traditional Western mode of child rearing, which has emphasized molding and socializing the child, began to be replaced by a different mode, more concerned with helping the child. And this is something that we've also seen with our midwives, or different midwives that we've spoken to, that there's... cool. You know, the wife is showing me a website. Cool. Is that there currently coexist two different approaches to child rearing, and you can see that with the different midwives. The old school midwives are quite, I don't know, I think Marie would probably agree, they seem to be a bit more cold. There we go, we won't mince words. Yeah, we were quite taken aback. But the Morse writes in The History of Childhood that because there's two fundamental ways of, or two different approaches to child rearing, the advice given to parents is contradictory and it causes a lot of confusion. And though it's not often spoken about at the time of writing of The History of Childhood, our friend Spock from the 1960s, you know, that guy who was going to save everyone's kids, comes up with the following statement. Now, it's too long to read, so I will just go to the bullet point. Effectively, he sums it up, and I'm paraphrasing him for brevity, is that one side of the fence works from the position that the child is actually a little human being who deserves respect and treated with kindness and be shown guidance only because they're inexperienced, and that you are preparing the ground for them to be their own human being. And on the other side of the fence is those who believe children are like a little blank animal that has to be basically coerced either through punishment or through regimen into becoming something suitable for society. And if it's not forcibly made into an acceptable human being, it's going to become a delinquent or a criminal. So in the context of that coin flip between recognizing a baby as a human being in development or an animal which needs to be basically tormented into being civilized, you can kind of get an impression of where the Western society has ended up.
Yeah, you know, I'm just, I had Truby King's page open here and I said here, his method to teach mothers domestic hygiene and childcare was strongly promoted through his first book on mother care, Feeding and Care of Baby, by a network of specially trained Karatani nurses.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I have to say here, in what sane world is it that a man writes a book on mother care and feeding and care of babies? That's just insane. He may well have been a very nice guy, but that's not right. That's just not...
Exactly. It's a non sequitur. It's like having a female urologist for men. I just, you know, she hasn't got a penis.
Going on a bit further here too, it says, apart from nutrition, Truby King's method specifically emphasized regularity of feeding, sleeping, and bowel movements.
Mm-hmm.
A generally strict regimen supposed to build character by avoiding cuddling and other attention.
Exactly. And this is the thing that, I mean, once my wig came off the top of my head. I'm not wearing a wig.
Actually, but just jumping in there, because I just realized that bit there about that I just read there was from a newspaper column called Our Babies.
Mm-hmm, yes,
and
right.
It was written by his wife.
Yes.
So between the two of them. And, you know, you see this regimentation of a particular part of Western society by experts. You know, you have the same thing much later on with all the sex experts who came in telling you, you know, what was and wasn't normal, what you should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's as if we can't do anything anymore without somebody telling us
worse,
what to do.
Worse still is that if you look at the background behind those bankrolling some of Truby King's work, it is effectively a eugenics program.
Well, it says they're strongly rooted in eugenics and patriotism.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So here we go. Turn of the century, last century. So 1907 and a bit, around there. We have this regimented methodology presented to the women of Britain, Australia and New Zealand as being a better way of, and it's written down, of making a superior human. Great. Okay, so we're going to institutionalize infancy. I mean, poor little buggers aren't actually, you know, they're barely out of the womb and we're already turning them into little clockwork toys. And why? Because we want superior human beings. And I can hear the industrialists of the era going, yes, and they'll make great factory workers too. Because if you're used to regimen, if you're used to eating at a certain time, taking a dump at a certain time, going to sleep at a certain time, well, hey, that's just the whole Western mechanized industrial world for you, right there from birth, from the moment you're out.
Wondering, you know, with all this sort of thing coming in then, you know, I started to wonder whether would World War I have come about without this pre-regimenting of the human being? Because you're making them, in one sense, turning people into little soldiers as well to take orders. You're teaching the parents that they need to take orders and be trained as to how to bring up their children.
It's and a the good children, question.
You know, it's passing on down. I don't know. I just got this weird, strange...
See, wonder. Yeah... Dub 1 kicks off in 1914. In 1907, he forms the society. It doesn't mean the ideas he had weren't already in position.
Well, exactly. It's going to have been happening because he's born 1858. Interesting date that he was born on, I have to say, tells you a lot.
Mm-hmm. April 1st. Hello. I know. You see, it just gets better and better. So there is another sacred cow firmly kicked onto a barbecue. Frankly.
And you see here how he was in 1889, he was in Dunedin as the medical superintendent at the Seacliff Lunatic Asylum.
Oh, hello.
And, you know, that's just, I would be a little bit, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be, but I might be a little bit worried if I'd found out that someone who was teaching me how to raise my child. I don't know, it just seems like, should you be in this camp or, you know, over here specializing in this or this over here?
Mm.
Or is your methods a mix? Are you putting these two things together? Or
yeah. Now here's a few words. Here's a few words about King that will, you know, I didn't write this. This is already written. He said, you know, despite the rigid rules propounded by Plunkett nurses, King himself was a man who thrived on disorder. Says here, biography-wise, he ate at irregular times, paid no attention to the state of his attire. He left travel plans to the last minute. He was careless with money. He talked interminably on his latest enthusiasm to anyone who would listen, and he was impatient with opposition. There were those who found this total engagement with his latest mission attractive, while others found him irritating and eccentric. Sorry. He is recorded after his move to Wellington as saying that he missed the insane.
Wow.
So now how is it that a man who himself is reasonably, disorganized, becomes a proponent for an incredibly regimented, organized way of rearing children?
Do you know, when you start to look at the experts, you find that again and again. Oh, Jesus, I can't remember his name. Going back to the sex thing, there was a guy in England, it's pretty big. And go on, are you going to suggest a name?
What? No, I was thinking the American guy.
No, this was back in the late 1800s, so towards the, you know, the turn of the century. But so he is writing about sex, this, that, and the other, and the guy is doesn't even have sex until he's 30 something.
Mm.
And then I think he has it like once or something, and then nothing for ages, and he's just like, he's got a really weird He's a deviant. Jesus, okay? He's just a bit of a deviant. And this is the guy who... I'm trying to remember his name. This is the guy who... you know, we're basing so much stuff on, and the later sex experts were also basing their works on.
Yep.
And you look at that guy, yeah, the American one, the...
Kinsey, is it?
Yeah, yeah, supposedly.
He was a deviant.
Children, and yeah. And we're all going, yes, this is the right, this is how we should be, this is normal. And, yeah, if it's come, if books have been written, and it's been on TV or talked about, and it's talked about in universities or whatever, and it's given a platform in the West, that means, yes, this is right, this is the way to go. These people know more than we do.
Yeah, and that stuff, I mean, following that follow the Pied Piper stuff will get you killed. I mean, I'm sure General Haig in W1 was a complete expert when it comes to, you know, modern trench warfare and strategy. Did him a lot of good. You know, got thousands and thousands and thousands of men killed, sometimes in the same hour. So, yeah, experts, not so much useful. I mean, I don't know. There seems to be a massive lack of humility that comes from suddenly being given, you know, a title like that. And it's a weird craving that some people have, you know, to be declared an expert.
Oh, it gives you, you know, have letters after your name. Whoa.
Mm.
You have the power and the glory.
Yep, it just means you've got a bit of alphabet glued to you.
It's like stuck on the bottom of your shoe, and it probably smells as well.
You got a PhD. That just means you've got the letters P, H, and D handy. If you ever need to do Scrabble, you're in. There you go. Just chuck those down there. Yeah, PhD, mate. What does that mean? It means that if I'm short of a P, I've got a P on the wall there. I just pick it off, put it on there. No, that's cheating. No. Educated. I can use more words than you've got. But yeah, so here's this regimented, methodical, clockwork toy universe created for the Australians, the British, and the Kiwis. I would also say probably the Canadians, and, you know, let's not even mention the Americans. I think
they probably have their own brand of something similar.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know what it is.
By the way, to my American friends, I love you all.
Oh, yeah. We love the Americans.
But just examine your origins. Look at the way you were treated as kids. Because, you know, we were talking about, or we were Skyping about cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
And it really got me thinking. Because, I mean, the obvious thing, the 1 minute elevator speech is that quite clearly we're immersed in a sea of human behavior which is deviant utterly through all society at all levels of society. We don't see it because we think it's normal. Now, we think it's normal to put a crying baby down because we're encouraged to put a crying baby down and just let it cry itself to sleep because it's going to have to learn when bedtime is. And there are some, you know, techniques for soothing and calming the infant to an extent, and then you're meant to walk away. Well, you know, Marie's found the preferred method is the method that real humans use in places where they don't have Sky TV, you know, or electricity for that matter, is that the infant's the future, and you cling to that thing, and you make sure that wee bub is as safe as possible and taken as, you know, much care of as possible, always, at all times.
You know, I didn't, when my son was born and I didn't have, had not come from a good background, had no idea how to do the mothering, all I had to go on was that I would not do to him what was done to me. That was it.
Yep.
But the other thing I've realized since then was that how I raised him was, and I've mentioned this to you before,
yep,
I knew how to be an older sister. And although I didn't realize it at the time, that's what I did. But there were certain things. One thing was I would never leave him to cry. That was just my thing. I would never leave him. So yep, even when I put him down to bed and he wouldn't go to sleep, he was crying. Even if I left him in his cot, I would stay with him until he fell asleep. This is when he's older, not when he's a baby. When he's a baby, you just don't leave. You just hold them until they
get. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just. There all the time. That's what you do. You know, I've seen a few of these recently where there's parents with their baby and they're either sitting somewhere and the baby's in the pram or whatever and the baby starts to cry and they ignore it. Or they don't do anything. And I'm just, well, you're supposed to pick it up, you know. Are you stupid?
Exactly.
The baby cries, you pick it up. And I just, I'm there, my arms are nearly trying to go out and pick up the baby myself. It's not even my baby. And I'm not a big, you know, huge baby, oochie-goochie person. But it's just what you do when a baby cries. You just, it's not hard.
I know.
Just reach down and pick them up. It's really quite easy. And you've got two hands, and the two hands want to do it. They're just raring to do it.
Exactly. Now, you've got to think about it. It's like if we go back to the early Plunkett days, so, winding it back to 1907. So we've had, in this country at least, generation after generation after generation being taught, look, if you want your child to be self-reliant and solid and independent, then when they cry in their cot when they're little, let them cry it out.
Yep.
You know, because otherwise they'll grow up to be soft and needy. And from the reading that Marie's been doing, it's the opposite is actually true. If you are tender and kind, if you you cradle and comfort the child and you give it the time and the attention that it needs, it grows up to be a much more rounded human being because it knows it's supported. It's got the support it needed when it was an infant, so it knows that there's love in the world and compassion, and it can actually become generous in giving those things too.
You know, Ashley Montague in that book, Neoteny, you know, he's saying the same thing. Children learn how to love by the treatment that they are given. They learn it. It's a learned thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, whatever you're doing to your children, that's, you're teaching them. You know, what are you teaching them?
Exactly.
Are you teaching them consideration and care, or are you just teaching them to be an automaton and a future zombie?
Exactly. And so we've been, I mean, this is the shocking stuff. And not that there weren't, I mean, I'm assuming, actually, reading between the lines, that these kind of techniques of destroying a human have been in place for much longer than Plunkett. But at least in our country, you know, you can actually put a pin in the calendar and say there was a systematic approach applied to the people of this country, which would ensure that you'd end up with obedient but emotionally stunted individuals. Now, I know people out there will be going, oh, you know, I was brought up that way and there's nothing wrong with me.
Didn't
and I'm
be any harm.
Exactly. And what I point out is that we don't know what the upper threshold of human compassion is. We don't know how compassionate a human can be. We know they can be very compassionate from people we may have known and met in our own life, but what is the upper limit of the human ability to express love? We don't know. That is a moonshot project. That is everybody on the planet, get together, heads together. We need to come up with a way of finding out. That is a worthy pursuit. Now, because we haven't had that, we've had the opposite. We've had the, how alienated and isolated can we make people and have them still function when it comes to working machinery? I think we found out.
Well, I think the system has worked perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
The system was there to create machines.
And it did.
Yeah. Mm. So it's working perfectly. There's actually no problem with it. The only problem is there are some irritating humans who, are finding a few flaws in this perfect system and who are going, hey, I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
But so, the system works wonderfully.
Oh, actually, yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you want a regimented sort of controlled society, then mission successful. The thing is, though, I mean, I just see it as, you know, a drain pipe circling dead end for a species that
it's dying. This system will kill itself. It can't not kill itself.
A system predicated simply on the exploitation of other human beings for its own sustained continuance is going to run out. Because eventually you end up with machines that can't repair themselves. And the machines that can't repair themselves can't repair the machine. The big machine, and then you end up with the whole thing ticking off. You know, the cogs stop turning. This thing killed itself the moment it decided it could run the planet without love.
Yeah. That's what we're seeing now, this kind of breakdown. There are people who think that they can keep going with it and they'll be all right. And they won't.
No, I mean, if the idea that if you support something which is fundamentally monstrous, because you support it, it won't turn and bite you, is incredibly naive and stupid, because it will.
That's a bit like giving money for cancer research.
Yeah, which is basically saying let's give money to not do anything about solving cancer.
I'm going to give money that way I won't get cancer.
Oh yeah, and yeah, it's a pardon, isn't it? Was it? It's a what was that Catholic thing?
Plenary indulgence, is it? Is it?
Oh, you've got to love that. What a neat invention. Yeah, I'm worried about going to hell. Really? You got any money on you? Yep. Well, there you go. You're off the hook. Shit, is it that easy?
Hey, we could sell that on Trade Me.
Yeah, plenary indulgences.
Yeah.
$1 minimum bid.
Yeah.
See where that goes. Thing is,
that'd be, it's eBay for Americans. So
how would
you can sell indulgences? That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, but how would they redeem it? I see the bright. Hang on,
don't
the right side.
Worry about that. If they're gormless enough to bite in the first place, you don't have to worry about that.
That's right. If they kick the bucket, they're not going to come
out after they kick the bucket. Just that standard Catholic or religious procedure. After you kick the bucket, you find out. That's all right. That's all right.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So, with the notion of the idea that we'll actually we're living in a society which is fundamentally estranged from its true humanity, and to the fullest degree of it. I mean, there's bits and pieces dripping through, but it's almost like, I don't know, this hose pipe is made out of 10-foot thick steel, and every now and then a little crack springs and a little bit of compassion comes pouring out, and somewhere some eagle-eyed engineer is going, shit, look at that. Oh, well, not to worry. The pressure's still up in the system. It'll carry on. But because we don't have a clean field to play in, we don't have a clean run at being a humane human being, from the very get-go, we don't know what it would be like to be brought up in a family where you had that 100% support because it was entirely natural to give it. And more so, instinctively, you should expect it, and it was actually there. I mean, it's not just that sort of like that Hollywood idea of a happy family. I'm talking about the fundamental human beings that you would need to generate a good upbringing currently don't exist on the planet in the form of an unmolested, humane being.
Well, you've jumped on, got into my hobby horse now, Fitzy.
Mm. Well, sorry about that.
So, well, because this is something else I'm worried about, wondering about. Oh, so one of the other things I was thinking as you were talking before about, so we got the plunket, but you've also got around that time, well, it was a bit before that, but you were only talking, I think, 20 or 30 years, really. The whole schooling program kicks in. The whole, you know, you have to go to school, you have to go,
yes.
You've built this many. So this is another huge thing put upon our society, this fake. So you've got the fakery with the Plunket of how you're going to raise your children, then the fakery of how you're going to educate them and how they have to be educated. Every single thing, you've got this regimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And yet my hobby horse is the family unit. And wondering just where did this same kind of regimentation of how, of what a family is, because to my mind, and the more I look at it, the family unit is not healthy, the way it is structured. You've got two people who have absolute power over however many children they have, and they mm-hmm. the right they have to that is because they had sex. They had sex, and nature took its course. Because of that, they now have the right to own, basically, the product of that of the sex act for, you know, however long the children are in their care. So you've just got these two people, and I have been in touch with a lot of different people, a lot of broken people, the product of families that are very broken. And so much comes down to one or two really broken parents.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually have broken parents and not have damaged children. It's not just down to that. It's down to the structure of the family, whether or not you can have broken parents who take responsibility. They understand that they have problems. And I've read of amazing stories where, because the parent is willing to, you know, take responsibility for, in cases like mental illness, that they suffer from schizophrenia or whatever, and admit to it, the family or others rally around them, and they all work together and have had quite amazing family groups. So it's, but what it seems to be is you've got to have people who are willing to be honest, be open, take responsibility for what's going on in their life. But I think the biggest thing I can see within the family unit is as soon as you have a small walled-in unit, you are in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Without daylight coming through, without the ability to open one door and step outside it and actually get other ways of being who you are.
And to get that really is more like you have your doors open and you allow others in. And the way I think about it more and more is a healthy or happy family is one that invites strangers into their home. And I don't mean you pull people off the street.
Oh, no. I mean, you can do that, but you need duct tape.
Yeah. But you mix. You willingly bring others into your children's lives because you know that parents can never be enough for their children. And they're not supposed to be. You know, parents are not supposed to be the everything of a child's life because the child is so amazing and has a mind that is so hungry that it's your duty. The parent's duty is to enrich the child's environment as much as possible to keep it safe. Their job is definitely to keep the child safe, to tend them, to feed them, those absolute most nurturing of duties. But also you've got the spiritual, the emotional, the mental, and you've just got to bring into a family and make sure that enough different ideas, different people, different ways of looking at the world is given to them so that they just expand to whatever it is they can be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. Yeah, I mean, it just occurs to me that we don't really know what the outer capacity is of anyone.
There's not, I think, I swear there wouldn't be one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Not meant to be one.
Yeah, and it'd be great to think that we had done and had done for us all that could be done to make sure that that balloon kept inflating. You know, and this is the significant. I swear, if we if you're brutally honest with yourself, you can spot the moments when the pin popped your balloon as you grew up. I mean, some of the people it kicked off really young, and others, you know, there'll be one or two exceedingly crucial moments where you go, shit, I'm never going to be more than what they say I am, which is terrible. Because, I mean, no one should ever consider that other people's opinions are enough or that their explanation for, you know, who or what you are is spot on. I mean,
it seems to me it's like a swallowing. There comes points when you swallow down something that you may have resisted for a long time, but you give in whether or not your head's been held under, you know, underwater or, you know, the emotional water or the whatever it is within the unit. And you swallow it down, you stop fighting, you buy into it. I think often we try and hold certain bits aside and protect it. I think sometimes we will, you know, pay off. We will swallow this, but we will hide this.
Yeah.
And that is so awful, but it seems to be the way we develop in the West.
Well, so, yeah,
you know, all these different systems that have been put in place, you know, every time you try to, you know, find an outlet, find a way to stay sane, stay whole, there's another pressure put on here. You know, you want to get away from the family. You've got to go. Where do you go? You've got to go to school. And you've got, you know, where's the place where you're safe and you can just grow and develop? And often there isn't a place.
No, in this country is particularly, it's profoundly hostile to people who like spending time alone.
I think that's quite a worldwide thing. You know, obviously you're a loner, you know, up and coming psychopath.
look out, you're a loner. You like spending time thinking about things. That must mean you're going to go crazy with a machete. Well, hang on a minute. What about all those, you know, Ivy League kids who got the education paid for them six times over, you know, and then ended up running a corporation into the ground after sacking all their employees and spending all the money on hookers and cocaine? Oh, no. They're fine. Pillars of society. But if you were to, yeah, I mean, it's my sort of all CEOs are psychopaths rant, but
if so you see a good little robot is a moving, talking, doing robot, not a sitting quietly, musing, looking up at the sky. You know, that's dangerous, danger, danger. They might have an original thought.
Yeah. It's funny because I flung that idea, it was a moment of what would you call it? It was like a whale or a keen, but I did it via email to a couple of chaps I know, and I said, you know, you probably heard, you probably did hear Neil Armstrong kick the bucket.
Saying that to me or to them?
To you, yeah. Neil Armstrong.
Oh, yes, yeah, I did hear something the other day, and I put a coffin in my latest article, actually, for him.
It's a bugger because when I was growing up, and this is pretty much my email list to the chaps I know, was saying, look, when I was growing up, we were all going to go into space. You know, when you're a kid, you're going to go into space one day.
You mean with the New Zealand space program?
Doesn't matter. It was going to happen somewhere. This is my putting my eight-year-old thinking on. We're going to have spaceships, and we're going to go to other planets, and we'd live in big bubbles, and we'd have, you know, dinner in a toothpaste tube, and it would be awesome, and we'd meet aliens, and we'd be their friends, and we'd fly around, and stuff would be really cool, and we'd have jetpacks and rockets and ray guns and all that kind of cool nifty stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they got to the end of that space program and said, you know, this is expensive, let's stop doing it. For whatever reason. And then, you know, we get to that sort of that gap, nothing much happens. And then, you know, the shuttle comes up, and all of a sudden we've got things like Hubble, and you can see, just astounding imagery of space. You know, one useful piece of technology humans managed to put above the Earth was the Hubble telescope, just for sheer beauty that it returned. And then, you know, you hear President Obama is pretty much, you know, kiboshed going back to the moon. And NASA's program for Mars and the other planets is basically drone-based stuff, so little robots, obviously. So sending someone to Mars is a nice idea, but hideously expensive, profoundly dangerous, hugely technologically challenging. So where is the hope for, you know, all us little eight-year-old boys out there, for the future where it was going to be, it was going to be that pristine white button-pushing future of flashing lights and amazing acceleration? We lost it all. I mean, with Neil Armstrong kicking the bucket, it kind of puts a nail in that coffin. When, you know, America was leading the world in space technology, and, you know, people were looking up almost in hope, I would hope. And we don't have that now. I'm thinking, for me, the space program that I've got going on my life is just simply to try and retain what humanity I have and make sure that I don't damage the little one. I mean, that to me is a worthy space shot kind of mission, or it's at least on par with it for just sheer challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, sorry you've lost your dream, Fancy.
Well, it's just that hope that, you know, you put down the rifles and the rocket launchers and you cobble together a UFO in your backyard and you fly around the planet and have good times, you know.
Maybe that's something for you and your son to work on as he grows old, that UFO in the backyard. That could be it.
Well, I'm hoping he'll make it into space in all the right ways and come back safely, although I don't think his mother will be applauding the idea of him going into space. But it's just, I mean, yeah, we're sorely tested at this point in history. You know, we're trying to wash this dust from our eyes, which turns us into robots, trying to get our humanity back, keep our compassion, remain calm, try and bring up offspring in the most undamaged manner possible, and hopefully they'll do an even better job than we do, and then their, you know, your grandkids will do an even better job than they did. Now, trying to get the human race on track to produce really well-rounded, supported, loved humans who will produce more of the same. And that's one way of climbing out of this bloody pit we're in, I'm hoping.
Yeah. The pit, it is a humanity or a humanity-less pit.
Yep.
You know, although you can look at pollution or...
sustainability!
...or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not. It's all... There's really the one thing. It's this... The zombie human sort of apocalypse, really. There's a movie in there.
I know.
This lack of humanity, of being able to feel, of doing the things that gives humans great pleasure. And, you know, the best person I know who can speak about that, or who I've spoken to recently, was Zach, who's 8 years old, who could remind me of what humanity is actually about. But we keep going back to other adults and thinking, you know, and having long chats, and we'll fix everything up and we'll... But we're useless. We're just fucking useless at living.
And thoroughly encouraged to be so.
Yeah, you just...
We're trained to die young and then carry on coasting through middle age, pretending that we're alive.
Well, you know, actually, you were bringing up something else there. Maybe we'll sort of have this little weird chat that goes here and there and everywhere. A lady left a comment on my an article I did the other week, and sort of a bit of a tossing to and fro about rest homes and so forth. And, you know, I got to thinking about how many old people there are in rest homes who are, and because my mother's in one now, and you see them, and they are, well, either they kind of just, they're like vegetables. They're different types of vegetables, but vegetables. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, these vegetable people are an amazing cash cow to the pharmaceutical company. The pharmaceutical companies are keeping them alive as vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may have extended lives, you know, 8, 10, God, who knows, years, because they're taking the drugs from the pharmaceutical companies. And there's actually an awful lot of money that goes into this kind of – the rest homes, they're real expensive places.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this feedback loop with the pharmaceutical companies. They're keeping bodies alive. There's not much else in there, and a lot of the times. And I just got to thinking about the monetary, how much of that is just about money. Here's a really good crop of drug-taking vegetable humans, and they have to keep taking the drugs or they'll die. So... you know, the drugs keep being made, they take them, they extend their lives. Nothing's happening, there's no quality of life, there's nothing. It's just the body's being kept alive. And is it being kept alive just to take the drugs, you know, these expensive drugs that pharmaceutical companies make? And I wondered. I really did. And I'm not talking about people. You can have people who are old and sick, but they want to live. You know, I'm not talking about them. I'm just wondering, and I'm not talking about euthanasia. I'm not into that. It's hard kind of say exactly where I'm coming from, but I just started wondering, you know.
Well, this is the horror of it. The medical system has made death the enemy, and put such high value on an animated chunk of meat continuing to have a pulse.
That's what it is.
And if you were to do anything to stop that, you're a murderer. Well, I mean, we've had some pretty high, one or two high profile cases in this country where people have assisted a parent the pass on, and, you know, bang, that's instant, that's manslaughter, if not murder charge, right there. And yet the doctors kill people every fucking day through negligence, stupidity, or just plain dumb bad luck.
Oh, and the pharmaceutical companies.
And they, it's like, oh, it's fine. That's fine. That's right. That's just, that's where we're allowed for that. And the statistics say that we can have 1% of all the people who die because they saw a doctor. Which works
only
out to
1%?
Be, it works out, well, you know, it works out to be a lot of human beings. And then, you know, of course, I don't know what the comeback is, but I suppose the doctors say, well, you know, medicine's not an exact science, or not exactly a science, I'm one of the two. But it is quite disturbing the moment. I think there's a metaphysical warning here on sort of like on the superhighway of personal, spiritual, and physical evolution, is that if there's a lay-by that says, doctor, keep going, just bypass it. There's something fundamentally dangerously wrong with putting your well-being in the hands of another person in that respect. There's something, it's almost like, I don't know, it makes me wonder if the whole point of having a medical fraternity is to get certain, you know, get people, living beings, real beings, to abdicate responsibility for their soul.
Well, you think, you come back and look at the medical profession, again, we've got another one of these regimented systems.
Mm-hmm.
With the experts that, yes, we rely on. And, you know, it's only sort of come to me recently about understanding that health is not the absence of disease, and the absence of disease is not health.
Mm.
You know, that's just then you're in a state of non-disease. But health is actually something, it's a different universe. You know, it's not the other side of the coin of illness. Health is another universe, another star system, another galaxy, I don't know what. It's got nothing to do with the lack of disease. It is a very real, living, vibrant thing.
Hmm.
And there is no, or very little, emphasis put on that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you take it that when your immune system is suppressed through drugs, alcohol, fatigue, injury, or, you know, stress, all that good stuff, then disease can rise up in you, not because you've been infected with something, but because it was already in you and it was waiting to have its, you know, shot at things. So, like, I mean, you can have a gut flora imbalance just by eating the wrong food. Now, that's not to say that, you know, you're a particularly bad person or you've got bad habits, but you can get sick very, very quickly because you're full of sick anyway. It's just waiting to get its chance to have a go in many cases. I mean, that's for that sort of thing. I mean, if you take it that we have bacteria living on our skin and actually living in us, bobbing around more or less under constant war from our immune system, but because it's so slight and so small and it can't really get a foothold, we basically have the outward appearance of not being diseased. But, you know, you get your acids and your alkalines out of whack, and bang, something will take off. They'll just go crazy. And so, you know, are we healthy beings waiting to be healthy or healthier or get sick, or are we actually sick beings who manage to suppress disease?
Yeah, I think that's more along the lines. And, I think, again, the way we're living, the way with all these different regimented systems, you don't really see health. You just see disease, or you see lack of disease. Health seems to be such a deep connection to life. And it's possible that people who have health can be ill, and then, you know, they recover. It's not like an absence of ill. It's a connection to life that, the more I look at it, I would say it comes from your gut. It's a belly connection to life. It's that connection to life that you see that the animals have, and it's a living thing. It's a living connection.
Yeah, in the same way that you could have someone who's very, very heavy still can run a mile and not get puffed, you know, just because your body shape or your outward appearance is a certain way doesn't mean that you're not full of life.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you're probably a lot of people out there with, perfect shaped abs and, blah blah blah, but they're not healthy at all. They just have the physical appearance of what we are told is healthy, but it's not. They're just grinding themselves into a particular shape, abusing themselves. Health is about really, it's just the connecting, this is your body, and yeah, the shape it is the shape that it is. It's yours, and you inhabit it.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, it's a universe within a universe. I mean, you're inside there, bobbing around somewhere as a point of consciousness, surrounded by, these walls of cells and these oceans of fluids. And, I mean, effectively, who knows? Maybe if there is, a location for the human soul, it's bobbing around in there somewhere, and its cell size, it's small enough to sort of knock about like a little remote controller. I don't know, someone wearing a little tiny spacesuit. Maybe it looks like Neil Armstrong. And you just put on this human bodysuit and bob around. And the difference between health and not health is that a healthy being can make do with what they've got and keep it working, whereas an unhealthy being can have been given a brand new sports model and fuck it right up.
Probably a lot of that again. I'm really thinking a lot that our lack of health, our illness, the way we've been driven into our head, out of our body and into our head. And so we're living in a place that simply does not have the capability of doing what we demand that it do. It is not, the head is not really a very bright bunny,
no?
It's pretty stupid. It's good for, it has peaks, it gets it right. But it just... In my previous article, I suggested that the head is like the male energy, and I don't mean to negative, but it's the bit that's upright. The male energy is an upright thrusting thing. So the head has been thrust up on top of the body. It has a very important function, but it's not built to stay erect all day, every day. It needs to recuperate. And The more I read, the more I understand, it's the belly is where everything comes from. It's the belly that, even the head needs to rest in a sense in the belly. If you come from there, you are balanced. So belly balance. There's a similarity, interesting similarity in the word sounds there. One is not better than the other. But, I was reading today about the navel. The navel's kind of seen as it's the birthplace of everything. That's how a baby begins to exist inside its mother's womb. It's through that connection at the navel. We radiate out from there, from the belly. So you can see that your legs and your arms and the head are something that radiates from the belly. But what we've done is we've gone, no. Bad body, get away from me. It's the head. The head is sacred. And honestly, it's so sad because I've seen so much mental illness, especially in the last 6 months. I swear it comes from this. The brain, the head, cannot take the pressure we put upon it.
Well, that's because,
in the belly or through the belly or be fed from the belly. It just can't cope. It goes crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, back to systems talking, it's doing exactly what it's meant to do, which is break down under pressure. Because, like you say, it was never built for it in the first place. So, well done, so society's engineers. But the thing is, I was thinking a wee bit about male energy, female energy there, is that I know we refer to male energies being sort of like, mind, and then female energy being intuitive. But I've sort of grown to think that, well, we've been given those. So, what if human energy, how to phrase it, even like the male gender itself, I mean, that's intrinsic. So you're I believe you're intrinsically male. You know, if you're born with a male body, you're a male. You can argue the toss all you like. You get really upset and say, no, that's it. I should have been a woman. But I don't really care. Intrinsically, and if we're going to be congruous, you are what you're born, which will annoy a lot of liberals, but there you go. But within that wonderful mechanism of body, it is the human inheritance of intellect and intuition. If you don't have intuition, you can't read your body. You won't hear it tell you what it's doing or what it needs. Any time I've gotten sick, I've known, very recently too, that I've felt it, I've known. So there's been a switch thrown and it said, you are now sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean in a creepy kind of like Twilight Zone way. I mean, the body says to me, hey, guess what? We just had one too many coffees. Or you've drunk one too many glasses of wine, or you've had too much sugar, you are now not well. You're out of balance. And then sure enough, bang. A few days later, got a cold or sore throat and all sorts of stuff going wrong. It tells me. It does. And but the creepy thing is, it tells me when it happens, and it's not. I'm not big on listening out for the lead up. Because I'm pretty sure it will be saying, oi, cut back on the sugary foods, you know, you're going to throw your stomach flora out, or cut back on the coffee, you know, too much caffeine, you're going to actually end up with a head cold or something like that. And I have been paying a bit more attention to it. You know, when you've got a bubby, you don't want to get sick because you get sick, you know, it's harder to take care of a child. And yeah, you're right. Health is intuitive. You must be connected to your body intuitively because it will whisper things to you. It'll even tell you what it needs to eat. Not when to eat, which is Plunkett kicking off in your head, but what to eat.
Yeah, that's, I mean, your taste buds are so finely tuned.
Mm.
You know, zillions of years old, you know, they will tell you the flavor that you want. It tastes really good. You know, that's a really good sign. It tastes really good to you and it satisfies you.
I've had my body say to me, you need some celery. And I've been thinking, I don't particularly like celery. I mean, it's all right, but not that fussed on it. It's usually right, you know. It's like, go and eat some celery, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, it's common sense, you know. There's a flavor, your body wants it, and you give it something else, and it just can't be satisfied. You know, it just doesn't satisfy, and you'll often eat more and more because you're trying to reach a satisfaction that you can't reach because you're giving it the wrong thing.
Mm.
It's speaking to you clearly.
Yeah, and we've been taught quite well how to ignore our intuition or our sense of body, which is great if you want to sell people sugary, caffeinated foods or alcohol or drugs or you name it, pharmaceuticals. I mean, get them to ignore all those natural ingredients lying around which could really, really make you better. And instead, have this pill which will give you piles, give you a distended rectum, rectal dysfunction, and give you a heart attack. But some of the side effects are even worse. That was just the treatment. It's like, what do I take this pill for again? Oh, it's because, you know, you should be eating celery and you're not. So just... But yeah, you're right. It's getting back to the intuition and humanity. Humans are an animal chassis. I mean, the animal chassis knows what it needs to keep going. I mean, even a frail or a compromised ill animal chassis or human being can pull a miracle out by going, okay, not going to do this, going to go over here, I need to drink this, I need to eat that, I need to get some sleep, I'm going to do this, going to do that, and listen to all those intuitions and actually follow them for a change, rather than going, oh, I've lived my life to the full, I've been a free spirit, and now I've got 18 diseases, my leg's fallen off, I've got this diabetes thing kicking around, I've got erectile dysfunction, my rectum's not working properly, the doctor gave me 18 pills, but fuck, I drank a lot of piss, and I'm so happy I did. Well done, humanity. Yeah. Getting back to you, health is actually getting back to your congruous self, I think.
Yeah. You know, there's also this thing where because we are so well trained in the head and, you know, head work, we're very good at explaining what we need to do, but we don't actually have the tools to do them. But because we are so good at explaining what we need to do, we are able to kind of ride right over the top of the thing which would say, actually, I don't know how to do this. I don't have the tools. I'm really, really good at talking about it. And I can talk to any other adult and they will be really, really good at talking back, and we'll talk it back and forth and back and forth about what we should do, and then we'll go away and do what we've always done. And there is this lack of usable tools. There is very few people out there who have tools that we can use. There's lots of people out there making a lot of money through a lot of lovely books that make you feel good, telling you about what you need to do, and also giving you things. You know, all those wonderful books about being in the now, you know, all those fucking awesome, be in the now, be present. You know, they piss me off so much. How the fuck do you do it? You know,
I'll tell you what, I bet
just 5 seconds and then it's gone.
Yep, I've been in the now, and guess what? It itched a little. Yeah, I think it might be kind of an eczema thing.
And then, but then you hear so many people, they will regurgitate. You know, they'll say it again. Yes, you've got to be in the now. When you're in the now, be in the moment, be in the flow. Fuck! You know?
It's basically...
We don't know how to do it. We can't stay there. You go there for a bit, and then your mind comes in, and there's no tools. So I just want to say, going back to the talking about the health and the food bit there, there is a lady I read recently who's Janine Roth, that was it, and she had this book called Women, Food and God. And sometimes I thought, oh, dear God, woman, would you hurry up and get on with it? And other times I thought, oh, what a genius. And she was the book was more for women, but it doesn't have to be, you know?
Yeah.
It's talking about how our relationship to food, within that sort of microcosm of our relationship to food, is our relationship to life. However we treat food, that's how we treat life. And one of her methods of actually, you know, so you don't just stay talking about it. One of the things that she gives was this meditation on the belly. So you actually just spend however much time you want to, bringing your attention back to your belly. And I do meditation every day. I used to hate it so much. I'm better now. But I started doing that. And at first was like, well, actually, I don't have a belly. There's nothing there. There's kind of like my head, and then there's my legs. But actually, there's nothing in the middle. I can't feel anything whatsoever.
Oh.
But I've stuck with it, and because of other work I'm doing as well, just starting to get a sensation of like, wow, there's something there. But another thing that she said was, as far as the food goes, is she had some certain rules. Her thing was, so she was, she'd gained and lost 1,000 pounds or something over her lifetime. Just incredible back forth. And she got to the place where basically it was suicide or give up dieting, because she just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she chose to give up dieting. Mm. And apparently she gorged herself on all sorts of chocolatey things for a few weeks.
Yeah.
But she made up rules for herself, and one of them was that she could eat whatever she wanted, but only when she was hungry. So anything she wanted, whenever she wanted, but only she had to be hungry first, and to finish, to stop when she wasn't hungry anymore.
Ooh.
And another thing she had was that no eating in front of the TV or while you're reading. So you had to do, if you're eating, you do your eating. And, you know, these are actually little tools that are usable, because we have become so headbound, and because we have lost our bodies, apart from the odd thrill with sex, because I think that's pretty much the only time people go in their bodies, that or when they are crucifying their body to make it look good through exercise or something.
Mm.
The rest of the time, we disowned our body. We disowned it.
Mm, yeah. Ascetism is, too many thoughts going through my tiny febrile brain. But, Yeah, the okay, so if you go back to those self-help books, and we have this whole, and I mean, there's plenty of people in the New Age movement espousing stuff like, effectively what they've got in mind is genocide for the ego. If we got rid of our egos, we'd be sweet. Everything would be so much better. But
And live in the now. You get rid of your ego and live in the now.
Yeah, I've got to get a whiteboard. I'll start writing this stuff down. Sure, there's a book on this. But the thing is, I mean, I agree with the following statement, that the ego is like a cell membrane. It wraps around all these goodies, which are the components that make up your personality and your experience and your history and your memories. And what it does is it forms an impervious body to stop all that good stuff spilling out. It's not necessarily there to be a rigid, hard surface which can't flex, but it retains enough of the intrinsic qualities of all those neat things that have been mixed together so that they don't dissolve, they don't become dissipated.
Well, I think the ego's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Give me that mine.
Mine's fucking huge. Got to try again to get you. Sorry about that. So ego is not the enemy, I think, that people make it out to be. Of course, that's a great thing, is once you've dissolved your ego, you're incredibly easy to manipulate. So,
very
very
good point.
Fundamentally wonderful for anyone who wants to start their own cult. Get a whole lot of people, tell them to lose their ego. Why? Well, because that's their identity.
Also, you know, that keeps you busy, because actually you can't really lose your ego. So that'll keep you busy for the rest of your life, trying to lose it.
Where is it? Is it around here somewhere?
Yes. No, look, it's under the sofa.
it was down the back question there. Oh, no, I'll tell you what it was. I was doing the old dust busting. I had the dust buster out, and I think, because you do sometimes, you know, you get a coin in there, I may have sucked up my ego into the dust buster. But I'll be buggered if I'm going through the pan to find it. It'll be covered in pubic hairs and cat fur and all sorts of nasty stuff. And old sticking plasters. Never explore the contents of your vacuum cleaner bag. It's not good.
No, it's not a pleasant. Well, at least wear some rubber gloves.
Yeah, or wear some form of rubber. That, what you get up to in the privacy of your own vacuuming fantasy is none of my business, but...
Yes, well, that must be what South Islanders get up to.
Yeah, well, the long and the short
we
of
in
it.
In the north.
A whole lot more decent. But, yeah, your ego's important, because it's not the ego that needs... You know, renovation.
You see, there it is again. Experts of some sort or another coming along and telling you what you need to do.
Mm.
You know, you need to cut back on this, you know, cut back on the ego, you know, or whether it's your babies or your schools or whatever, but always, there's always someone to tell you. And you think, magazines, that's how magazines make all their money and have their power. They're experts telling you what to do. You know, how to dress, how to put on makeup, how to lose weight, which exercise to do, you know, which is the new miracle food.
Mm.
It's just full of other people who are experts telling you what to do.
Mm. I mean, I've got it in my head that, back to that great term again, unmolested, a human being has the whole blueprint of their life and the course of the evolution laid out inside them. Rating just to, you know, it just pings off on its own clock. And if we are allowed to develop naturally, we'll actually fall into that rhythm. And, you know, there's effort involved, obviously, but you have a blueprint. I'm not saying that it's predetermined so much as it is what you are fundamentally. So in touch with your intuition, being in the moment, having dissolved your ego, in all seriousness, if you're in touch with that intrinsic self, then you will find a moment of quiet, because being you and growing as you are is not a spectator sport. You know, you'll come to the conclusions that you do that lead you to the moments that you need, which will grow you, and you'll come out of those moments better for them, rather than this don't trust your instinct, don't trust your intuition, eat this bar of chocolate, drink this piss, go to bed with this loose individual that you just picked up in a bar, and fuck's sake, don't follow your inner dreams or your own inner voice of intuition. And that's what we've got. We've got a whole lot of robots running around going, feed me more programs. Why? You got a master program, run with that one. Oh, fuck no, can't load that up. Why not? Because I've been ignoring it for so long, I no longer know how to.
Yeah, well, I think, in a sense, we've been trained to make it feel wrong. So we've been trained to make our that inner blueprint, that inner structure, that the basic humanity structure that we all were born with, it doesn't feel right now. It feels all creepy and weird, and because we're so bent out of shape.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't feel right anymore.
Exactly. We are the deviants we're afraid of, and the parents warned you about. I mean, our entire society has become deviant. It doesn't trust its own individual's intuition. They'll give us all driver's licenses if we ask nicely and pass the test and give some money to the government. So it'll trust you to operate heavy machinery at high speed, but it won't trust you to operate your own life. What the fuck's up with that?
No, and you're seen as a deviant if you do try and operate your own life. You know, you do, you know, what are you doing? I'm using my own mind. What? Stop it at once. It's filthy.
Yeah, dirty mind. What's it thinking now? Well, I'm thinking I should eat some more celery. Oh, well, there's your problem. Some bloody vegetarian nonsense going on. Go out there and eat a cow. Well, we've already barbecued the Plunkett cow, so I suppose I could. I mean,
so one of the things it seems to me is we have to find some teachers, some wise people who will teach us, give us actually usable methods to, not if you don't want to, you know, I don't. If someone wants to stay in that world, well, that's fine. They need to stay in that world. I'm not dragging anyone. But,
oh, yeah.
But for those who, you know, would like to explore what being a human being is like, explore the potential, find out what we're capable of.
Yeah.
Then we actually, people get annoyed when I say that we're stupid. But I think we're really stupid. The word stupid is like, in a stupor, in a haze of...
discombobulated.
Yeah. Lacking in so many fundamental basic senses that we are stupid.
Yeah.
That people get so upset by that word. I'll say, I am so stupid. But that's a good sign for me, because it means if I realize I'm that stupid, I must have an inkling of what I might be capable of.
Well, if you look at the structure of the language, the word stupid as in S-T-U-P-I-D, or the word stupored,
mm-hmm.
where you've drunk so much you become stupored.
Yeah.
It's the same fucking word.
It is. It is like we're living in a stupor, you know?
Yeah, we're drunk.
You know, that's the title of my blog, you know, too long in this place. It's just, you know, you're just dozing and dreaming too long in this place. It's like being in some kind of a drugged state and it's foggy and you know there's more, but you're just so stupid. Stupid because you don't have the tools. And that's, you know, so I'm looking for people. I swear at the moment by Edward de Bono, Robert Fritz, because they actually give you tools that you can use. They're not selling you new age dreams.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
They're helping to
help that stupor blow away, to just help you come to your senses. Okay. But that just means, look, I don't have the tools. I love using my mind, you know. I don't like this idea to, just get in back into your body and, you know, and let go of the mind. No, fuck that. I love using my mind. It's enormous. Gives me enormous pleasure. I think it was the only place that was safe for me. I'm not going to give up that place. I've worked very hard to develop it. But what else can I be? How much more can I be? And I know I need to also return to my body. I miss it, you know, I miss it. I didn't want to leave it, but I did. I know I left it.
Mm. Yeah. And I was thinking about it too, actually, the last 24 hours. Look, if you're not – I was actually mowing the lawn, to tell the truth. I was out there mowing the push my there, a bit of green grass.
What a man. Kind of. What a guy.
I know. Yeah, it was all muscle power, baby. But
do you have a black singlet on and gumboots?
Oh, I must get a pair of them. Oh, it's on the shopping list. Hang on, put that down there. I wonder if they trade me. Hang on. Trade me. Black. No, hang on. Okay, get back. Sorry. No, on track. I was considering this one thing, and it kind of really, you know, considering where my head was about, how old am I now? Shut up. About 25 years ago. That you come to this planet, however we end up here, you miss everything if you turn your back on it and decide you want to be ascetic and you try and live this existence of negation where, you know, you won't give in to the temptation and the pleasures of the flesh and you'll just a simple, humble life and then kick the bucket and go and hang out with God, play croquet and stuff. The point of evolution here, I mean, different people have written this and it's a bit New Agey and some, I kind of agree with it, is that in the time, if there is a timeless state that exists beyond this, in that timeless state, nothing changes because it doesn't have to. It's timeless. There's no active ingredient of change. You come here, you change. You have to come here and actively change and work hard at changing. Possibly because when you leave this place, that new changed thing exists in a solid state, almost like, I don't know, trinkets on a shelf somewhere. You know, perhaps the infinite is collecting little porcelain dolls and we're it. But
fuck that. I'm not going to be his porcelain doll.
You know what I mean.
He can go stick it up his ass.
Yep. Take that, Jehovah. Oh, that's you, sir. There's the hemorrhoids again. But
go on, you sorry.
Yeah, just if there is timelessness outside this, and it kind of strikes me that it should be, that we're the moment of raggedy-ass, mad, slapdash panic running around, bright lights and screams and jumping up and down and clapping your hands kind of moment in effectively a massive void before you and after you of unchanging timelessness. So you want to, you know, when you're here, you really want to get your teeth into it. You know, you don't want to come home, sit on the couch and watch a soap opera. You know, you don't want to go to work. No. Day in, day out for a lifetime. You don't. What you want to do is live your life to the full, if possible, and, you know, love, brazenly love life and throw yourself into everything. If you could. You know, I couldn't. You know, that was not the childhood encouragement that I got. But I'm looking at a photo of my bub and I'm thinking, well, mate, guess what? I'm not putting any of my shit on you. You'll run free in the fields of the infinite. Yeah. Do whatever the hell makes your heart, you know, swell with absolute joy, and that should be yours and always. And that's the minimum standard for getting a human being to be a human being. If that's not our preset mode of existence, then we are not ourselves. That's not right.
No. Well, we know there's a lot of things not right.
Oh yeah.
You know, I was talking to my son now. We have quite a few conversations, actually, and but one of the ones we're talking about death, and because I've you know, well, I think we all think about this, and one of the things I thought about once was that how, when you think about it, all of our, well, once you sort of grown up, once you get past, I suppose, a certain age, in a sense, all your life is focused on death.
Yeah.
And I played with this thing once about, you know, what if I lived for 10,000 years? I thought 5,000 didn't seem enough, so 10,000 years.
5,000? Oh, hell, you're still a teenager.
What would I do? It was very interesting. I mean, at that time, there was just two things. It was quit my horrible job, and I would just go and learn, and I just wouldn't stop learning. I just wanted to learn so many things. But what I also found was the difference in feel. And how, now I've noticed often, you know, there'd be things in my life that I say, oh, no, I won't bother because you're kind of going to die sometime. So it's always like it's not worth starting because it would take too long to learn or to do or whatever.
Mm.
And, you know, talking to my son, just how, in a sense, every decision that you make once you're aware of death always brings death into the equation. You know, even if it's just down to, oh, I'd better not do that in case, you know, I might have an accident, and you know, whether it's dangerous or this, that, or the other, or whatever. Not just death, but old age and death. You know, how much time have I got left? What can I do? And we're factoring in all along. And
it dominates everything. It becomes the bloody horizon.
It does. And you've got your, I think you're like your Eastern kind of, you know, get one with death, you know, get comfortable with it, or, you know, go and lie in your grave and all that sort of thing. Or the West has its own weird stuff. A lot of this about, you know, sort of, and often it's like a denial of death and, you know, just keep the, you know, those little meaty individual, those meaty vegetables in the rest times, keep them ticking over, you know, fear death, fear death. I actually think death is just doesn't make any sense, you know. And whenever I try and talk about it, people want to come back and prove to me why it's so important. And I just think, sorry, I don't even know why we got on this subject. But, you know, it doesn't make any sense that we have such short lives, you know.
Yeah.
Really, we should live a lot longer so that in the evolutionary sense, we've actually been around long enough to pass on some really decent stuff to the younger ones. But instead, nowadays, you've just got a bunch of vegetables in an old folks' home passing on nothing. Or you've got people who've grown up in this society who have nothing to bugger all to offer anyway, because they are, you know, a part of that programmed regimen.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just interesting how much, it was interesting to me see how much death, even if you're not thinking about it, is incorporated into every facet of your life. It's a weird world. It's weird the way we live, you know?
Can you mention two things? Not living at all considering death.
Mm-hmm.
And still being mentally sane and healthy. So it wasn't like you're going to stand, try and stop a train with the, you know, I read this the other day. There was this guy, I think he was a Russian psychic. He'd worked out that he could stop things like dogs and cats and cars and bicycles with just using the power of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
He tried it with a train. Train won. Now, that's not the kind of not living, you know, not thinking about death I'm talking about. I mean, like, obviously, don't step off a cliff or, you know, try and stop a Boeing 747 wearing a Borat thong and jumping up and down really high. Just don't do it.
Well, but that would probably stop the pilot.
but the idea that you fully accept the finality of life without contemplating it constantly. You know, I'm not talking not that jackass style of jumping off, you know, a perfectly good boat onto the back of a swordfish and hoping it doesn't spike you. You know, hey, I wrestled a swordfish. Or running up to a bear and, you know, kicking it in the balls. No, don't do that. But just that you can live a happy, healthy life without constantly living in fear of it ending.
But can we? Because it's pushed upon you all the time. Even if you wanted to forget about it, there's always something or someone to push it on you.
We'll go back to Shakespeare on that one. You look at things like Hamlet. You know, it's inevitable. From the very first letter on the first page, Hamlet is going to kick the bucket. Sorry, spoiler alert. Oh, look, if you don't know Hamlet by now, I'm sorry, kids. Yeah, look, Hamlet dies. There you go. Yes. Yeah, played by Kenneth Branagh.
4 hours long.
Yeah.
Just come in for the last 10 minutes.
It's a chore. Ooh. But anyway, that... The English tragedy, or actually the whole notion of tragedy, and the Greeks fuckers started this too, the notion of a fated death, you know, something you can't get away from, and the audience,
the gods are in charge, and the fates or the gods or something.
And the audience can see it coming, but the character obviously can't, and that's what makes it tragic, is that, you know, this poor buffoon is running around inside this, you know, play arena, and doom's approaching, but we're encouraged to either identify with the hero who brings back the boon from our great adventure, making society better for our sacrifice, and then we chuck in the hero has to die. Aha! So in order to bring back any benefit or boon to our own life, something has to die. is that what they keep telling us?
Mm.
So effectively, don't dig down deep into your own intuition and pull out that intrinsic blueprint for your own existence, because you'll die.
It's like that. It's held over us. You know, I really do wonder about death, and maybe it's just my particular trauma at age 5, finding out the way my mother sort of told me, but it's stuck with me, and nobody questions or seems to want to question death. I do. I just, just in terms of like having an exploration, it doesn't make sense to me. Every time, you know, I try and bring this up, people will, it's like that regurgitation of, well, because of what they've been taught, because of what they know, will explain to me why it's so important that people die, because it keeps life going and blah, 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 blah. Sometimes I can do a really good job of helping them to just think in a different way. Death actually doesn't make sense to me, and I don't know why it makes sense to so many people. We understand the seasons, you know. We understand that, you know, they come and they go and they move around and you see them, you know. They're gone, but they come back. They're gone and they come back. So that's all fine. But with death, something that was there 1 minute is gone forever.
Yeah, it just doesn't add up.
It doesn't add up. And, sometimes I think, is there death because everybody believes there is death?
I got the feeling.
Have we created it? Have we made it a reality? Have we caused this vanishing to happen because we have bought into it, you know? And if we questioned it, you know, I wouldn't, it isn't that I have a drastic problem with it. It's like, oh my God, I'm so afraid of it. Well, I think when you're dead, you're just dead. So there's not much to it, really. I mean, but the bone I pick with it is what it does to the people left behind, you know? It crucifies people. And how many times in your life will you be crucified by the death of someone that you love? It seems to me an extreme cruelty.
Oh yeah.
You know, when you're given one phone call, one some idea, and I know there's spiritual churches, and but I really, in my time I've been there, and but it's not enough. It's not decent. You know, it's not a it doesn't equate to your one last phone call before you get executed or whatever, you know. It's not even that. It feels more like they're just picking up on a few bits and pieces, you know. I don't know. But death doesn't make sense. It seems like it's an extremely good control mechanism for us. Because we're so afraid of it, or even if we say we're not, we may not be afraid of our own death, but we're very afraid of losing the people that we love. So it does still have a hold on us. And we factor it into everything. And it just seems like if you wanted to control a species, you factor this thing in. You factor this complete disappearance. And then all you need to do is bring in the religions to give you different answers. You know, religion, I don't think, wouldn't really have much power if there wasn't for death. And so many things in this world wouldn't have much power if it wasn't for death. Again, you jump yourself, think, you know, play with it. I'm going to live for 10,000 years. Would you be going to church? I just don't think so.
Can you imagine the mayhem? This is a virus well worth engineering in a lab somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Set yourself up a lab. Come up with the Methuselah virus. So all of a sudden, it's going to go through and it's going to reprogram your DNA so that it's super duper hyper efficient at the restoration, regeneration, reinvigoration of all your cells. So not only are you going to live for 10,000 years, you can't die before then anyway. Short of being, you know, melted down in a bloody volcano, you're going to carry on and all your bits will grow back, and it's just fantastic. Now take that out there, shake it up, throw it into a busy airport somewhere, and then, you know, everybody around the planet within about 6 weeks has caught Methuselah. So for the first few you know, weeks, gets curious, because you know, old Uncle Edgar, who, you know, was due to, you know, pass on, didn't, disconcertingly, and then he started looking a bit younger, and then he looked much healthier. And then he got up out of his sick bed and, you know, he said, you know what? I'm going to the Bahamas to shag cocktail waitresses. Off he goes onto a plane. Never see Uncle Edgar again. You know, he is off to have time of his life, which will be about another 9,999 years and 11 months. And all of a sudden, people will be looking at each other. So I say, you know, all these roles we played, like, you know, I was his father or I was his son. What does it mean? Someone lives 10,000 years.
That's right.
They become meaningless pretty quick. All of a sudden, what is the state? Well, it's a very temporary way of organizing things. But guess what? If you got a whole lot of bureaucrats, although they are vicious bastards, I was going to say, you get a whole lot of bureaucrats would go, I'm going to live 10,000 years, I'm out of here, I'm going to have fun. But there would be a few go, that's it, I'm going to make life miserable for you bastards for the next 9,000 years. You fucker! I guarantee someone in Wellington would love to live 10,000 years, to put all those rules in place.
I don't think they could keep it up for that long.
It would be funny, eh? Like, imagine being a parking meter maid. Like, oh, you work for the old council there, you put the old ticket on the parking ticket down there, and you're going to live for 10,000 years. Oh, fuck, I'm out of here. No, you stick around for 1,000 years. Plug of that. No, I'm not doing it.
I think you would become nomadic. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I feel. I feel you would just travel slowly around the world. You know, you would just travel... And you would slow down so much, not because you got to drag out time, not at all, just because you would actually relax.
Mm.
See, then it makes me realize it just things like that, when you think about it, take out that fear of death that's always on you, that pressure on you, to either that forces you to try and squeeze more things out of your life, or otherwise you hold your breath because it's not really worth it, you're going to die. It's, you know, you shape yourself so much around death. But take that away, and the enthusiasm for you—it's quite easy, I think, to think about what you like, what matters to you. You know, you ask people now, "What do you want?" And they go, "I don't know." But now factor in 10,000 years, and it's much easier to say what you want, to own what you want.
You know what I do, eh? Oh, man, I'd take out a massive bet against global warming. I'd get 100 years down the track and go, see, I told you, fuckers. Now give me your money. I told you it wasn't us. Bloody sun, you dickheads. What do you think heats the planet? Oh, it's us. Yeah. Well,
you'd probably find the whole monetary system would collapse. So much would collapse because...
Well, we would go to work.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, that was my immediate thing. Well, I'd just give up my job.
I mean, why bother? You do something useful. It's like, what are you going to do for 10,000 years? Do the same shit I've been doing for the last, you know, 30 years of my life? No.
Exactly. It's a very interesting game to play. Just play it with yourself to see.
Yeah.
And it changes your views quite amazingly.
I can imagine a bunch of Rothschild bankers sitting around going, how can we keep them enthused? Oh, that's right. We'll make things really expensive. Going to cost you $1,000 for a loaf of bread. So you better get back to work, chump, for the next 10,000 years. You know, someone would try and game it. Someone would want to put us back in our box.
I actually don't think those systems could hold in place. I really don't. I think they would all collapse. I think, again, so much of this revolves around this fear and this... the fear that comes through death, through your small world, and you're going to get old and you've got to save for the future, and you know, and all those systems, all those, that power in place, you know, it makes me wonder if something, whatever it is that seems to control the world, you know, maybe it's just an accidental and we've slipped it. I don't know, but it feels so cleverly done.
Mm.
You know, way beyond the Western civilization, which just seems to be like a small piece of it.
Oh,
something
yeah.
Yep. Much larger, something so well orchestrated. Well, you have to have the control factor. And I would say the control factor is not money, it's not religion, it's not political power, whatever. It's death. So put that in place. And then you can bring in all the other things, and then they all make sense. But live for 10,000 years, I don't think any of those things would last because they would stop making sense.
It makes me think almost that if it's not a human invention, then this cunning system is actually deathless. So it doesn't suffer from death. Like, it not only can it could lose power and cease to have influence, but it in itself maybe is deathless, cannot die.
Perhaps, yeah. Well, it seems to have been around a very long time.
Oh, forever.
And you know what? Maybe it's the same thing as us. You know, that's it, that we would be deathless as well. So
as
if one part of it split off from the other or something like that. You've got, imagine you took two deathless, I don't know, systems, societies, I don't know what quite to call it, and you convinced one to believe in death. Well, you've got it. You've got it under control.
Exactly. And that's what I'm thinking is that we're, you know, we could fart a universe into existence tomorrow out of sheer petulance and joy of life. But we've forgotten. And we've been convinced that we're these little tiny microbes running around on the arse end of the universe. We're not. And yet the illusion is so convincing that the tools we had to do all that, they're out of reach now. Either we become so dumbed down we can't actually recognize them in ourselves, or they are quite literally so heavy and majestic and powerful that our grip on them is too feeble to actually wield it as power or actuate
it
them.
It could be like so many things with the balance, you know, with that system of balance where it's this quite a fine line in the middle is where you get movement or whatever, you know. If you want to surf, you know, there's just that point on the wave. You can't just go in anywhere. And if you want to ride a bicycle, you know, you've got to be upright at that point of balance to get your momentum, to get your moving going. You know, I was thinking as well, you know, if death was brought in and over a period of time, and then to make sense of it, we may have dreamed up old age to sort of explain death, you know. Oh, well, this is you die because you wear out, and, you know, because you look at, again, as much as the fear of death, you've got the fear of age, which is the pre-death, and how afraid we are of that. And honestly, fair enough, too. It looks bloody awful.
It does, yeah. The you know? Absence of, so, of, yeah.
Of, yeah. Of so many things, you know. I was wiping my mother's bottom the other day, okay? It's not pleasant.
No, I know.
And it's not pleasant to contemplate becoming like that yourself, you know. It's not, and to see all the, someone said, you know, one of the sort of biggest acts of courage actually is to live, to be an old person, because of, you know, it's not just the indignities, but they seem to suffer so many things. But you look how many people talk themselves into old age. They consider it, they contemplate it, they talk about it, they you know, this, so much attention is focused on it. You know, the media today is always, you know, they'll tell you, you know, what age somebody is. They're always got to tell you how old somebody is. Mm. We've always got to know how old somebody is.
It's quite interesting. If you get, I've noticed this, I've seen this in people who, you get to a certain age. some people, it varies between, but definitely there's this absolutely high speed decay rate where you can have someone who's quite active, well into their 70s and fairly fit and healthy, and then they might have a fall, or they'll catch a particularly bad bout of pneumonia or something, and then, you know, 2 weeks later they look like they're 90. And all the energy's gone, and they're basically, it's almost like they've already died. And there seems to be this psychological component which says, now be old.
Yeah.
Like, and old beyond restitution. You know, there's no rest, you're not going to regenerate, there's going to be no energy coming back, you're old now. And now do all the right things, like sit around, don't do much, don't get up, be frail, and lose all your strength. But it almost, it's, God, it sounds like a set of instructions.
I think it is. I think that's exactly what it is. We have been instructed to age, and we instruct each other to age.
Yeah. We should do the opposite.
Exactly.
Imagine growing young. It'd be great.
Yeah. Like, or, you know, whatever possibility there might be, I don't know what that would be, you know. I think, you know, if you live for 10,000 years, well, obviously the...
You don't want to be 10,000 years in a wheelchair, eh? It's like, nah, fuck that.
Well, and that's what people tend to think, you know, oh, it'd be like this. No, it wouldn't. Hello, wake up, you know. That's the difference between health and living and this death thing that we're, you know, we, no, no, you know, if I try and sort of bring up death to have a discussion sometimes, people go, oh, no, you've got to, because otherwise there'd be too many people in the world, or there'd be, you know, you've got to kill off the old ones too. And it's, you know, it's bought and paid for, that whole idea. But, you know, flying used to once be, it didn't, you know, it's not complete. We all, you know, they all knew it was completely impossible.
Can't be done.
Yeah. How many things have been absolutely impossible because everyone knows this is how it is?
Honestly.
And then it happens, you know? So, you at least have to allow the possibility, play with it, that there are other ways of living, other ways of being. You know, there are other, if there are other planets, other aliens, whatever,
exactly.
I'm quite sure they live long, long lives because it's really the only thing that makes sense.
Exactly. I mean, I was musing over it. All right. I was thinking, microphone's gone silly. Just, universe is massive, and anything that could be. And yet here we are, convincing ourselves of our smallness. It's just, so you've got to be kidding.
Yeah, and getting smaller all the time, and stupider and frailer and sicker and...
Yeah. Don't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make evolutionary sense.
I mean, it's almost, I can almost feel aliens buzzing by the planet, looking down going, well, that's weird. That civilization convinced itself it was small and minor. And because it convinced itself of that, it just did. Turn small and minor. That's weird. That's a deviation. Mark that up. I'll tell you what, Nigel, put that on the map. We won't go there. That looks a bit wrong to me. And they eat cheese. What's up with that? But in all seriousness, I'm pretty much leaning towards the idea that the universe, there's kind of a consistency. There's massive variety, variation throughout the universe. Not that I can prove it. But there's a consistency, which is any form that chooses can choose to be any form.
Yeah.
In a circular, bit of a circular argument there, but effectively, you know, if you will yourself to be a certain way, then so be it, and that becomes true. So if you will yourself to live forever, that's what happens.
Yeah, or you might, you know, decide to play, you know, play that game. You know, maybe somehow the... playing with some kind of bizarre, weird idea that this the death thing that we do splits our consciousness or ourselves into splinters us, and maybe where there should have been perhaps a lot less of us living very long lives, by keep dying and sort of fracturing or splintering yourselves, and so where there was one who would have been this long developed being, you die and you fracture, and then you sort of, you know, maybe there's like splinters of you, and there's 3, 4, 5, 6. It maybe, I'm playing here, okay, I'm just playing.
Sounds great.
But maybe that could explain the large quantity of zombie people in the world, you know, that there are fractured parts of us out there that kind of like not whole selves, you know, not what we should have been, this one condensed, very rich being, but by being forced into death again and again, you know, we splinter, bits break off, and you get these kind of small kind of echoes that come back that are...
for want of a better term, not really living.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of the, you know, the echo of an echo.
Yeah.
Or the shadow of a shadow.
Yeah. Maybe there's actually not. Maybe Earth has actually a small population, and a lot of these shadow characters that are, just fractured particles of, you know, of a self that should have been very rich, but got tricked into death and tricked into old age and tricked into, you know, giving up its timelessness.
Mm.
I'm playing, you know.
Oh, that sounds good. I think it's probably, there's some truth there in that. Yeah, we're not marginal. And this is why it occurred to me a while back, I've been pondering it, is that we've all got some kind of intrinsic interior blueprint for how to be the ultimate version of the one we are, whatever that is. And not the one, but, you know, the human being that we are at the moment, there's a perfected form of that somehow. And that if we lived that life, we'd amalgamate with others who'd done the same. Not in some kind of great big hive mind bullshit, but it's just that if we're fragments of the infinite or some massive intelligence, then you want to assemble it or reassemble it in the right order. You don't want to just sort of slap bits on and hope you end up with something that vaguely looks intelligent. So we have a kind of a duty of care to our own soul to bring about that pattern of a happy, well-lived life, which glues to other well-lived lives and some kind of amazing jigsaw puzzle which comes together. And then there is your big one, or your amalgamation of forms into sort of like a super form.
Or, you know, it could also be the opposite. You know, with the work of Robert Fritz, and when you think about it again, you know, it makes sense that, and this is apparently in the East, I don't know if it's all the East, or some of the East, in terms of like religion or whatever, the creation is what matters.
Mm.
Creator, they don't bother. They're not bothered about who created the universe. They're just bothered about the creation. But the West, it's all about God, you know? It's all about God. It's all about if someone has invented something, so much, it's about the inventor. You know, their big name, flashing red lights, you know? Huge.
Yeah.
And it's about, this is what this person made, this person, it's their invention. In truth, with creation, it is the creation that matters and not the creator.
Mm-hmm.
If you bother about the creator, you're never going to get the creation, because that's why identity is such a trap. You know, you're so stuck in this is me, look at me, 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 that you're not creating anything. For instance, with you now, you would say it's your son that matters.
Mm-hmm.
No, science would say, well, you and your wife have created this child. You know, you are the father and the mother. But you know, in a sense, you don't matter. He matters. Everything is towards him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and any creation is towards, it's the creator. Yes, the creator brings it into being, but it's the creation. This, you love something into being. So what I was trying to say with what you were saying there is maybe it's the other way, you know? If there was an entity, a single entity, and this entity created us, that entity cares more about us, unlike the Western God.
Yeah.
Okay? We are the creation. We are the jewels, the absolute jewels, the treasure. Now, that creation would want, that creator would want us, his creation, to go on and become creators also. And so it's maybe an outward, creationing outwards. You know, we become the creators, and we create. And our creations create, which is what, you know, if you look at nature, that's what it's about. It's about that forward momentum. You know, the creation becomes the creator and so forth.
We're like a firework that has the capacity of creating new fireworks.
Exactly. So maybe, and for myself, I must admit, I don't want to go back into any, I wouldn't want to be amalgamated into anything.
Me neither.
I have done too much, experienced too much. I want to go out and create more. I want to be more. I can't settle for less. I want more.
I don't want that all as one. Kumbaya, everyone hold hands. We're all sort of one big amalgamated blob of something. It's like, guess what? There's nothing there. It's a car park, and it's an empty car park at that.
Yeah, it would be stopping after you started, you know. It would be
the death of your evolution.
Yeah. It's death. You see, there it is again. There's that death thing again. That's kind of interesting. What death does. Jesus, I wonder if death is connected to oneness. Well, wouldn't that be interesting?
Oh, you,
oneness equals death. And
you glue those two. Yeah, you glue that together, and then bang, you can just shoot down every religion in existence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that whole consensus group kind of dynamic is effectively the death of ego, because you have to be subsumed into the group ego or the group mind, which is not what I'm suggesting at all. I mean, I wouldn't want that for any beings. I think you need to retain 100% your richness, you know, of what you are, and then in concert with other beings of a similar concentrated form, you can make some new song, but you don't drown all the notes in one dull note. I mean, the greatest music has high contrast between, you know, low and high notes and all that sort of great stuff. Can you imagine, I don't know, the work of Beethoven if it was just one note? It'd be like, boom.
Wouldn't really much work, really.
No, it wouldn't really work. It'd be like, hey, okay, here's a song called Ode to Joy. Ready? Fuck, that was amazing. I could listen to that for hours. I mean, and that's what religions kind of ask us to do. That's what politics asks us to do. So subsume your own opinions and your beliefs and your thoughts into the group thought, which is...
Ode to flatulence.
Effectively. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the crazy individuals, the loners who are, you know, the dangerous loners, are people who are going, walking down the street, making up song. Why are you doing that, buddy? Making my own song. Oh, no, you got to sing the group song. Sing the national anthem. Go fuck yourselves. There's no national anthem because there's no nations.
No, don't stop it.
The one of the most boring national anthems in the history of national anthems, eh?
Yes, it's shocking.
Seriously, I have changed lyrics of that so many times to include numerous swear words.
But even with that, it's the whole tone and the whole everything is just so bad.
Yeah. At least Australians have a good one.
Oh, is that the Waltzing Matilda one, is it?
No, but it's Advanced Australia Fair, but it's a bit more upbeat. Okay.
It's a bit more upbeat.
It's almost got a rhythm.
Yeah.
Advanced Australia Fair.
It's an Australian accent. Well done, Fitzy.
I'll tell you what, the French have got a good one.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like you're going off yachting. Yeah, you can have some big adventure. I'm a Frenchman with self-removing trousers. I'm going on an adventure. Fantastic stuff. But ours is... Seriously, it is that monotone.
Yeah.
It is. It's just
anyone who's interested can look it up. We are not going to sing it, but it's
no.
It's serious. It's like a hymn. It's like a church hymn, but worse.
The Corporation of New Zealand is boring. Mm. It has a boring theme song.
Yeah, very.
You want a really good. I want a theme song that involves a dog and drinking beer and lots of giggles and, you know, sort of like Busty Maidens and Barnes and things like that.
That's a bit kind of German, nice. Perhaps.
Oh, there you go. What's the German national anthem like? I've never listened to it, eh? I think they changed it after 19...
Deutschland ist über alles. Well, that's if they still have that one.
Is it? They didn't change it after 1945?
Well, they might. I don't know. I probably just watched some old movies and that's why I don't know. Yeah, maybe they wouldn't say that. I don't know.
Oh, dear. And there you have it. You know, you have to have lots of notes in a song. You have to have lots of different individual people making up a species and doing anything of interest. Otherwise, I mean, it all boils down to this one murky, egoless, grey mush of tedium, which is pretty much where they've got us. I mean, it's fun.
Sameness, isn't it? It's just, and that's what makes you scream, you know. Sameness just makes you scream because it's so... awful. It's against everything that's alive.
Mm. Yeah. And Terence McKenna said that it appeared to him that the universe brings about novelty. In fact, highly novel, the escalation of novelty is like the escalation in part of complexity. So you have hydrogen and, you know, have a proton and an electron. There's hydrogen. And at the other end of the periodic table, you've got something big. With, you know, gazillions of protons and bazillions of electrons buzzing around it. And, I mean, to get all that to hold together, pretty nifty. But there it is. And then out of all those weird sort of atomic forms, you end up with a myriad of molecules and then you end up with cells and then all the sort of life running around. I mean, things just get more and more novel.
Well, you know, you remind me there of, again, the work of Edward de Bono, because... So what you're saying there, you're talking about, you know, it's an evolutionary process about how things are put together and then that creates new things and so forth. And, well, if you were to look at this world, then Well, apart from, you know, perhaps dolphins or whales or something who are smarter than us.
Ants.
The human species is very different and very advanced in a very different way to animals on this planet. You know, we have this thinking ability. And what, you know, De Bono says is that what we need to do, he said evolution is too slow, you know. So that randomness, that novelty that you're talking about is actually one of the tools that he uses in his work, you know, in his helping people, teaching people to think. So, and the thing is, you know, we've got it. We have got the ability to, so if you need randomness, you know, to go to a dictionary, open it up anywhere, pick a word out, and apply that word to whatever thing that you're thinking about. And you've got that instant randomness, that instant novelty. Now, that is so easy for us to do. Once you have that tool and know to do that, you know, it's so easy. So it seems like we are this evolutionary godsend, this evolutionary wonder for this planet. And we've been dumbed down to Matthew Deleuze, you know, talks to us like a plastic dog turd, you know, which is really quite good. So we have within us, at our fingertips, within our brain, with our, you know, ability to what we can do with our mind when we have the tools, this ability to evolve at a phenomenal rate. And, you know, you see, it's been done with technology, but, you know, well, whoop-de-doo. What about as a human species, as emotional beings, as human beings, as people who feel, as people who want to connect with life, with the earth? We have the ability to dive into evolution at a phenomenal rate and evolve ourselves. Surely that is what nature wants of us. If we've been endowed with these abilities, that is what our job is, to evolve very fast, very richly, but we don't. We're not willing to admit how bloody stupid we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no. And, you know, I try and have conversations sometimes with people about thinking, oh, no, I do this. And you can't get it across. No, we do not know how to think. We have been using the same thinking system that Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates put in place, and this is through the work of Edward de Bono, about 2,500 years ago. Okay, the church saw that the system that they had evolved was really good for the church. So they pulled it in. They pulled it in through the monasteries. It became a part of it's the fabric of what we have become. You know, show me in your house what technology you are using at the moment that's 2,500 years old. You know, do you have a long drop toilet out in the garden or?
Well, we do.
You do?
Because of the earthquake created dig one. Yeah, it's still there.
Okay, well, that's just the rural classes of South Island, New Zealand. But for the rest of the world, you know, do you have stone wheels on your wheelbarrow that you use, that you push into the market to get your vegetables?
No.
There is nothing else in our life that we have got. Even their religions are not as old as that. You know, well, not most of them. So we're using this thing, and we will fight each other to keep using this 2,500-year-old system.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can prove that it's a good system, because that's the nature of the system, in a sense, to prove that it's a good system, to prove itself, to keep itself going. But it doesn't help us evolve. It holds us. Not only does it hold us, it is taking us to death.
Mm.
Okay, it's a death system. It may have been good up to a point, But like so many things, after that point, they become more and more deadly. You know, salt on your food, up to a point, great. You know, then you keep applying it. You know, you're going to get really sick.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, we are using, we don't know how to think. And that's, why can't we accept that? You know, why can't we say, oh, okay, we know it all the time, you know, ask someone to think of something, you know, think of this, you know, tell me what you want, blah, blah, blah. And they can't, you know, think of, imagine something you've never experienced before. You can't do it. But if I give you a couple of different random words, you know, a different random ideas, those novel ideas that you talk about with nature, you know, when it put this element together, then your mind will start to work. But your mind doesn't work well without tools. And we weren't given good tools. We weren't given tools. The tools we are using now are really destructive for us.
Yeah, they're duds. They're like Kmart tools. You know, take them back. These things are plastic and they break.
Yeah.
What do I pay all this money for? This is useless. Can you imagine actually the early universe if it did evolve at all? First proton, electron got together and, you know, whoo-hoo, we've been hydrogen. Quiet for a wee bit. Next minute someone says, you know what you could do? What? Well, you took two protons, chuck in a few more. Go on. Go and chuck in a neutron. Here you go. You got hydrogen. No, it's helium. Is it? Shit. Oh! So, you know, you got some lithium. People, imagine how outrageous it got. You got up to oxygen and people are like, oh, this is just bizarre. Look at that. Look at all those protons buzzing around there, held in place by all those electrons. That's just amazing. And, of course, you get a little pipeline from the back of the audience saying, don't forget the strong and weak nuclear forces. Well, we haven't. And then someone says, you know what? It'd be a shame not to get some magnetism going. Well, you got to have electricity for that. Yes, but you got to have electrons moving around to create a magnetic field. An electrical field. Before you know it, things are, I mean, honestly, the stand-up comedy routine you could do with the start of the universe when people are like, oh, I still remember when it was just protons. Just protons, mate. No neutrons. Oh, fancy with your neutrons, eh? Side of the universe we lived on, we had protons and electrons, and that was good enough for us, mate. And then you come along with your fancy neutrons. Hey, hey,
had trying to change things, yeah, trying to change things. We don't, things are good just the way they are. We've been using this system for 2.5 million years. It works fine for us.
You imagine that when uranium showed up. Like, hello, I'm uranium-235. I've got 235 protons. Oh, shit, fight started. Oh. They're throwing shoes at each other and recrimination.
They'll think you're better than us, don't you, mate, because you've got more electrons. Well, guess what? We were here first.
It's always been done this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's always been a hydrogen atom in the universe, and there always will. Arr. But that's when you get down to fundamentals, you know. We are, at our most base nature, really content with remaining the way we are.
But, you know, I don't think we are. I think that's part of the program. Without that programming, again, going back to your Plunkett nurses and your schooling, whatever, I don't think we could have become so stupid and so accepting of things staying exactly the way they are. It's not natural. That study, that neoteny, that sort of philosophy of neoteny, which says that a species that retains the characteristics of the infant when it goes into adulthood is meant to retain the traits of the young of that species. So humans don't actually change much from babies to adults. We get longer, our limbs get longer, you know, we get taller, but we stay pretty similar. You look at, you know, they're always taking us back to, oh, you know, back when we were the monkeys or the chimpanzees. But you look at your monkeys, a baby monkey and an adult monkey, extremely different. The whole shape of the face changes so much. And most species are like that. I think it's called gerontology or something like that, where it's, so they develop, in that sense, the idea is that because they change so much, then they're meant to develop the characteristics of the mature animal. But humans, we stay so like an infant human that the belief is that we're meant to keep the traits. So keep the traits of children. And Ashley Montague in that book, Growing Young, suggesting that the evolvement of the human species is towards becoming younger and younger. in terms of
our playfulness and our sort of
exactly
our enthusiasm our, for whatever. Life. And,
but also, you know what makes sense to me, going back to that sort of death and old age thing, if we are meant to grow younger and younger, that does suggest we're not, even more so, it's against nature, that this aging process is not natural for us, not that way. It doesn't make sense. That's putting on that kind of aging that belongs with other species that change so much and grow towards that. Doesn't suit us at all. It's possibly unnatural.
There's some big thinkings.
Yeah.
My brain thoughts are swollen. In a completely natural platonic way. Oh, God, that sounds wrong too. Jeez, he's not getting away from it.
Bloody South Islanders.
I was born in the North Island.
Yeah, but you've been there that long now that you're really a South Islander.
Oh, think.
You've lost any sense of Jaffiness.
I've been there for 12 years.
Yeah, that's it.
But trying to get out. But every time I move, they're dragging me back in. Speaking of moving, it's probably time to move to bed.
Yes, I was just thinking something. Well, actually, no, that sounds wrong too.
That sounds right.
You should go to bed, yeah.
I have to get up tomorrow again.
Oh, yeah, look at that. It's 11:11.
Oh, wow. My God. You know what that means, don't you? Nothing.
Yeah. That's my feeling on 11:11. Actually, it means fuck all.
Yeah.
It's a game.
It's a game, yeah.
It's a trick.
Yeah. Cool trick, mind you.
Oh, it's done well. Sold lots of books and things. Oh. Yep, I reckon it's a trick. All right, then, Fitzy, that's been great catching up with you. And congratulations to you on the birth of your son and to Marie.
Yay.
And we just wish you all sorts of wonderful 10,000-year-long experiences.
Oh, awesome. That would be great. He is the center of my universe.
Mm-hmm. Sounds adorable.
I think it's kind of neat. You know, you fall into orbit around your child. Your child doesn't orbit you. You know, I mean, it's like, oh, well, the child's got to fit in with your family lifestyle. They haven't got a family lifestyle.
He's your son.
Yeah, he is my son. So hence, I'm in orbit around him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the big shining one, and you're the little,
The old little burnt out cinder.
Yeah.
The old wrinkly burnt out cinder.
Oh, are you doing that old age thing? Give it a rest, Fitzy.
That's right.
Just grow young, will you?
I'm quite happy to be in his orbit. It's quite nice. Cool. All right, then, Auntie Alex.
Yeah, you have great fun with him tomorrow. And, yeah, great to catch up with you again.
Thanks, mate.
All right.
I'll catch ya.
Okay. See ya.
See you.
Bye.